This week on Pop of Culture, we head to Kansas. Well, not really, but we'll speak to playwright Catherine Trishman about how her career took her there.
I think what's really extraordinary about it is that when you drive out past the Walmart, you really do feel like you've landed on the moon.
Then we'll tie on aprons and head to the kitchen to bake a pie.
Everything is carefully measured, but the chocolate is measured by love.
Yeah, that's right.
That's coming up on this encore edition of Pop of Culture.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
From IPR, this is Pop of Culture. I'm Michelle Kinsey.
And I'm Jen Blackmer. Happy New Year! Happy New Year, Michelle.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you, Jen.
This week, we are listening back to some of our favorite interviews from season one.
In our Conversations Between the Coasts segment, we've spoken to artists from all over East Central Indiana and the Midwest who have made the choice to live and work away from the coastal cultural hubs.
Last summer, we spoke to a playwright who landed in Hays, Kansas, Catherine Trishman, playwright extraordinaire, who has had work performed, produced pretty much everywhere. Catherine, your biography is extensive. You've had plays produced all across the country and all around the world.
I have. Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to talk to you today, Jen.
So tell us about your journey, Catherine. Tell us where you started and why you decided to be a theater artist, how you decided. Some of us don't even decide. Some of us just sort of wind up doing this. And so how did that start for you?
I like to say that I came to playwriting through process of elimination. I was one of those kids and teenagers who just had to create all the time. Whether it was dance or choreography, acting, bad poems, I just was always creating. And I went to college certainly with the performance bug, but I think pretty quickly it became clear that I did not have the necessary tools to be a professional actor.
same here. And right. I also love, if I could say to you, how bad poetry is often a theme, because I have notebooks full of it.
Yes, I think there's something, poetry is such a wonderful form for when you're full of angst and 15.
Totally.
Right. So it was probably my first love of writing, but all my 15-year-old poems were very bad, of course. And then as you get older, you realize, oh, writing poems is incredibly hard and requires a level of just such pristine word choice and originality and a real love.
It isn't just, you know, blahing on a page. It's actually like craft. And
That's right. So I had to move on from poetry, but I have this distinct memory of being in a play in college and the director asked us to write character bios for the characters that we were playing. And I turned mine in. And the director and the assistant director and everyone who read it was like, oh, my goodness, this character bio is amazing. It's so well written. And it was really clear that my character bio was much more impressive than my acting.
You probably, it could be that you were just not giving yourself enough credit. But it also, I think, has to do with how much fun it probably was writing the bio. Is that true?
I think I just had more talent as a writer than I did as an actor. And it took me a little bit of time to figure that out. But really, by my mid-20s, everyone kept encouraging my writing and being a little about my acting. And so I started getting serious about my writing. And I'm originally from Athens, Georgia, and I did my MFA in playwriting at the University of Georgia.
All right. And where did you go to college initially?
I went to college at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Mm. And what was extraordinary about that experience is that we had a black box theater. We did 12 shows a year in the black box theater, and it was completely student produced, student directed, student run.
Wow.
So we just had this playground space, and the folks who came out of that space are extraordinary. And I think that honestly was the most extraordinary education that I had.
actually doing the thing instead of sitting in a classroom learning about the thing. You're actually just sort of putting a room together and said, you know, make art.
Right. I was doing the thing with really bright people, really committed people, even though we were young, and we would do silly things like someone would read, you know, a Brecht essay and decide that we needed to, you know, produce Brecht in the style as he intended, whatever that means to a 21-year-old. But then we would do that.
And for our audience, Bertolt Brecht is a theater artist who came up with this idea of alienation theater, which sounds like it would be a lot of fun to play with in like a black box situation.
And so, of course, the shows were terrible, probably, in retrospect, but it was such an extraordinary learning process. And also, it taught us so much just about being a professional theater artist, because at the end of the day, half the time you do need to self-produce. There are certain times in your career where you want to self-produce. And having done that for 4 years was great.
Sure. And it's that sense of actually going out and making something happen rather than sitting around waiting for something to come to you.
That's right.
Yeah. So you were in, you got your MFA in Georgia. And then after that, what else? What happened next?
After I got my MFA, I did do the Fringe Festival circuit. So I had a play done at the New York Fringe Festival. And then I took a play to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. So again, I was taking that model of self-producing and doing your own work and taking the work to exciting places, and also giving myself sort of a deadline to finish pieces and an opportunity to create work with friends, honestly.
Right. And that deadline is super important because it keeps you from just kind of, you know, sitting and letting it ferment in your brain or on your computer or typewriter or whatever. Right. It's important to have that time when you get the work out there and actually share it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the play that I took to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival is a little play called Crooked, and it's just a 3-character play with 3 women. And I wrote it for my friends. And that play rather extraordinarily just was my professional breakout play and took me on a great journey. It was my first professional premiere. I got my first agent, and just it opened a lot of doors for me professionally.
And that started because you self-produced it at Edinburgh. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's incredible. So then after Crooked, then what?
Well, then this is where it gets interesting in terms of my geography. So my husband is a philosophy professor, and at the time we were actually living in D.C., and I was, you know, starting this playwriting career, and he was starting his philosophy career. As you can imagine, we really just didn't have any money and or health insurance.
Right.
And he got this tenure track job at Fort Hays State University. It's out on the Great Plains in the middle of nowhere in western Kansas. And at the time, we just, you know, we needed the money. We needed some security. And we thought, oh, we'll just be there a couple of years. And here, almost 20 years later, we still live in this little town on the Great Plains.
Yeah, that sounds kind of familiar, because that's how I wound up in Muncie, Indiana. Again, it's a bigger city, slightly bigger than Hays, Kansas. So tell us a little bit about Hays and where you live and what it's like.
So Hays is halfway between Denver and Kansas City. I think what's really extraordinary about it is that when you drive out past the Walmart, you really do feel like you've landed on the moon. There's just nothing for miles and miles around. So even though the city itself, it's 20,000, it's not teeny tiny, but we're very isolated geographically. And sometimes I do feel like I live in a different country.
So how did you, so you said you'd be out in Hays for a couple of years. How did you feel when you first landed there? Because you were on the cusp of a pretty intense career at that point, right?
It is true that I was represented by CAA, and I was sort of meeting with movie producers, and it was a very strange time to decide to move to Hays. But for whatever reason, there was just something in me that really wanted that security. I was the idea of living in New York or LA, and just, I don't know, having to cobble together a living while pitching and trying to land jobs just wasn't appealing to me. I was 30 at the time, so maybe that's part of it. Maybe I was like, that's something one can do in their 20s, but I'm done with that. Mm-hmm. So I just really wanted the security. And I also just wanted time to write. I didn't want to, I don't know. I cared more about having time to do the things I wanted to do than I did about certain professional milestones. And I would say my husband and I are very similar in that way, in that we both value time.
Yeah. And that's something that seems to be in very short supply all over the place. But especially, yeah. I think in that, and because you were talking about the grind really of pitching and getting jobs and getting work and always thinking about the next thing, which is also something that was not appealing to me when I was starting to consider where I was going to wind up. And this sense of you're so focused on that next thing that you can't think about the thing you're working on. Does that sound correct?
Yeah, that's right. And I just think I have a sort of anxious personality, and I was sort of happy to let that go.
So what was the first play you wrote after you moved to Kansas?
So the first play I wrote here was How the World Began, which was very much inspired by this landscape and by the questions that were arising in this landscape. So when we first moved out here, you know, there was another effort to have creationism taught in the school districts in Kansas during that time period. And so there were multiple sort of open community forums with people discussing the issues of, you know, teaching creationism in the classroom. And what I found so interesting about those discussions, you know, was less the intellectual content of them and more the passion and the anger and the psychology that I saw at work among both the folks representing the side of science and those representing the side of religion. And so I took those debates and married it with the a town near us called Greensburg, Kansas. Is actually not that close to us, about 3 hours away.
Right, but it is a real town, yeah.
But it's a real town, yeah. And it was completely destroyed by a tornado sort of the first year that we were out here. So I married, you know, all these different elements and created the play How the World Began.
And so have you found, I guess, that your work is kind of inspired by these types of situations where you may find yourself in a place with a group of people you may not agree with, either, you know, politically or socially? Does that happen a fair amount?
I think it's certainly true. Like I've always been very influenced by the geography of where I live. So my early plays, a lot of them were set in the South where I grew up. And when I moved out here, I sort of devoured all the literature of the Great Plains, Willa Cather. Ian Fraser has a great book on the Great Plains and read about the Dust Bowl and the history of this area. So I think I've just always been a little bit influenced by geography. And I do have a tendency, I'm just a little bit of a contrarian. So I always want to hear the counter argument of basically any debate. So I think that it's more that quality that influences my plays as much as anything else. I mean, it's not that I was like so fascinated by the creationism science debate, but I certainly was fascinated by the psychology of it.
And I think there's a passion too in places that you find that you sort of tap into. One of the things that I do love about your work, Catherine, is that you call it being contrarian, right? Or seeing things from opposing points of view. To me, at least, that is one of the hallmarks of an excellent storyteller. And I feel, at least, and this could be, you know, my age, I guess, that we're in a place right now where that is less and less a part of the experience of going to the theater, the movies. It's almost like you're being told what to think rather than being given a situation where you can come to your own conclusion, right?
Yes, I am a real fan of ambiguous endings.
Right, I do good ambiguous endings.
I know, I love an ambiguous ending. I love to sort of like pose a question to the audience and sort of serve it up to them and then let them leave the theater to discuss it amongst themselves. But truthfully, I did write that play. It's been a while. I mean, I feel like I wrote that at least 15 years ago. So I don't know if I would necessarily have the same approach in our current political environment. But I think that holds true in terms of a strong drive to justify the thoughts and actions of any character that I'm writing.
So Talk about the, because you said Hayes is a city of about 20,000. So what kinds of, do you do sort of local things as well as, you know, writing plays that are kind of done everywhere? Do you work locally? Are there any opportunities out there?
That's a great question. So when I would say the first decade that I was out here, I very much divided my thinking about work and home. So for the first 10 years, I only worked outside of Hayes. And then I came home and I took care of my family and I wrote the next thing. But I had a very divided attitude about work and home. And it's an attitude that I can't entirely explain. I mean, part of it is certainly that all the theater done here is amateur for the most part. Mm-hmm. And it felt very separate from what I was doing professionally. You know, there's not a single equity actor, you know,
well, sure. Yeah.
100
yeah.
miles in any direction. So that was certainly part of it. But I also think maybe it was a bit of both a prejudice on my part and also just busyness on my part. Right. So I was raising babies and working in New York and doing things locally just wasn't at the top of my list. But what's so fascinating is that really in the past 5 years, my focus has really changed to local work. And it's been the biggest gift.
Mm. Can you go further with that? Can you tell me why?
I can. So part of it was certainly COVID, right?
COVID. So we're now at a position, I think, right now where we're thinking of the gifts that time maybe gave to us.
Right. So professional theater came to a grinding halt.
It did.
And then when restrictions were lifted, like 30% of theaters across America have closed. I think that's the statistic. Please correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, it's earth shattering, I should say, in a lot of ways that a lot of institutions who have been there for a while are experiencing some very significant challenges.
Yeah, and there's just not as many opportunities for new plays as there was pre-pandemic. Like I had two commissions ready for production when the pandemic hit and all that came to a stop. Mm-hmm. But what developed here is part of it was through a friendship. A man named Alexander Wood, who is a local composer, music director, choir conductor, and founding artistic director of this wonderful music festival called the Ad Astra Music Festival. And it takes place about 30 minutes from where we live. And I knew it was here. They've been running for 10 years, but it really was about 5 years ago that I started getting involved with it. And Alex just has a tremendous vision for rural arts and what should happen in rural spaces artistically. And every summer he raises a ton of money and just creates these really extraordinary music events, marrying professional artists from out of town with local community choirs and doing exciting new work and reinvigorated classics. And when I saw what Alex was doing just 30 minutes away, it really opened my eyes to what was possible in rural spaces.
Oh, that's excellent. And so what happens at the festival? Can you tell me a little bit more about kind of the nitty gritty of it?
Yeah. So a lot happens. So it's usually 3 weekends in the month of July, and they program a variety of musical events. So it might be a traditional musical. It might be a new opera. They commissioned an opera and built a stage in a local park where it was performed a couple of years ago. Last year, they did this experimental German expressionistic chorus.
That's awesome.
Like in the woods by an abandoned farmhouse. And as the like chorus wrapped up, the coyotes started responding to the music.
Wow.
And we would be like ferried to the space, you know, in SUVs. So they just really create unique musical events. I think one thing that's been fun about it is I am learning about different art forms. You know, I very much come from a writer, playwright, theater perspective, and I don't know that I could have predicted that I would be writing musicals.
That's awesome.
It's part of my career. But that's been part of the fun for me is to open up this whole new world.
And I think that's also, you know, what we do as artists in general, right? We're constantly kind of, we look at what we do, but then also what we want to do, right? Or what we want to be able to do, or what we want to learn how to do. So that's incredible. And just this idea of an opera in the middle of Kansas, like on a makeshift stage, is incredible to me.
I know, it really is. It's really extraordinary what they do. And I think, I mean, that is sort of the blessing of rural spaces, right? Because if I were in an urban environment, I would never be invited into the classical musical world, right? Like I'm just too far afield from that. But because there's just so few professional artists where I live, Alex and I found one another. I'm like, okay, how can we help one another create great art here?
And that to me sounds like a slightly different goal, right, than you may have if you were living in an urban environment, which is very much you're kind of siloed into the thing that you do because there's, you know, hundreds or thousands of other people that do the other stuff, right?
Yeah,
so
that's right.
It seems like it's a bit of a different goal that you're not trying to succeed in one particular area. Let's say you're more trying to kind of tell a story in a larger level.
That's right. And that we want to create, you know, meaningful, professional, excellent artistic events where we live. And that's just not the goal that I had when I moved here.
Right.
I wanted to create that in New York, in LA, wherever. And now I want to do that where I live as well. And that's a big shift in thinking.
And the thing I love about this, too, is one of the recurring themes of these conversations that we've had over the last several weeks on our show is that audiences are everywhere. Right. So you can be doing an opera in the middle of a forest with coyotes as your background singers and and people will come. Right. And people will appreciate what you do and respond to what you do.
It's true. And also talent is everywhere. I mean, not everyone has the most pristine training, but man, talent is everywhere. Even, you know, in rural Western Kansas, you can find amazing voices.
Yeah, I believe that. I definitely believe that. And I also want to experience this festival because it sounds wonderful.
Well, next year, Jen.
All right. I'll be emailing you offline. So just be looking for that. So what's next for you? What are you working on now, Catherine?
Well, I'm definitely in musical world. So our first musical is called Ghost Girl. And we just this spring did a professional demo of it. So we're pitching that places. So I'd love to develop that further, probably somewhere outside of Hayes, just because of our needs with it. And then, Jen, you're going to love this. I just finished I'm calling it an existential comedy. It's about three middle-aged ladies who are seduced by a vampire who looks like Paul Giamatti.
Oh my God. You should see the look on our producer's face right now. I am so there for that.
So I just got notes on that one from my agent. So I'll revise that this summer and then we'll start pitching that one around.
Amazing. So you're planning on then staying in Hayes for the near future. And I know that there's obviously, you know, family there and your husband teaches. What advice do you have for folks who are creators who may find themselves in smaller cities, smaller towns, or rural places?
Well, interestingly, I think it's the same advice that I have for young artists working in urban spaces, which is certainly to find your people. And I know you adhere to that as well.
Absolutely.
Wherever you are, we just, you know, we don't create theater alone. So you have to find your people. And, you know, it may be that your people are an hour away. It may be that you find someone in your backyard, like I was lucky enough to do. But you have to find your people. And then you have to find your funders.
Yeah, well, because they're part of your people.
That's right.
Listen, Catherine, it has been such a joy to spend time with you today and to talk with you about your work and about what it's like living in Hayes. And thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for inviting me. What a joy.
Catherine Trishman is a playwright living in Hayes, Kansas. We spoke to her in 2024. This is is Pop of Culture. If you're listening to me right now, you survive the holidays.
Yes, indeed. There are, of course, many things we love about the holidays.
Time with our loved ones.
Pretty lights.
And food.
Yeah, mostly food. Which got us thinking about our interview with Susan Danner, known locally as the Pie Lady. Here's our co-host, Kara Duquette.
We are here today with local culinary pie artist, Susan Danner. Susan is known throughout the region as the Pie Lady. It's nice to be with you here today, where it all happens, where the magic of the pie happens.
Well, I'm glad you're here.
Thanks for having us. I wanted to start by asking you to tell us a little bit about your ties to Muncie and your pie journey.
Well, my ties to Muncie go way back. I'm the 8th or 9th generation that's lived here in this area.
Whoa.
Even before it was Muncie. I haven't lived here always, but I always come back. As far as the Pie Lady, it started out that when I retired back in 2008, my daughter Moth and I, we decided we needed to do something that was together.
Yeah.
So we had a friend that was in Hartford City, and they said, well, you know, we've got this market up here in Hartford City. Why don't you come and learn about it? So we did, and the gentleman there was so nice. So we thought, well, what can we take? Well, we bake, so we'll take some baked things. So we had a variety of things, cookies, some breads, just a variety of things. And people really seemed to enjoy food. So fine. So we decided that maybe we could do this in Muncie. So the fellow's name was Jim, and we talked with him, and he said, of course, I'll help you, you know, tell you what to do to get started and everything. So he did, and we started the market, and oh my, I can't even remember how many years ago it was, but was the Muncie Makers Market, still is, and it, my booth kind of evolved. As I said, I started making cookies and little breads and small size pies and that type of thing, and the pies seemed to be what people wanted.
How many pie recipes do you have, or how many pies do you make with any regularity?
Every market, I make between 100 and 150 pies.
Wow.
And I'll brag a little. I sell out usually fairly fast.
What does that process look like? Because, I mean, we make 1 to 2 pies for like Thanksgiving or something. Talk about how you make 100 of them.
Well, okay. The ones I take to the market are 6-inch pies. So they're a small size pie. And we joke because people say, oh, well, I like that one, and I like that one. Well, I'll just get them both. They're little.
Solution.
Yeah. And how I start out, it takes me 2 full days. And what I do is, ahead of time, I make the pie crusts. And I know exactly how much it takes for a pie crust. So then I'll make that, I'll divide the pie crusts, and I freeze them. So then when it comes time to start the baking, I'll take a few out of the freezer at a time, and I'll roll them out.
So I'll roll it out. Maybe. Sometimes they roll out easier than others.
I do the one crust pies first, like the pecan, that kind of thing, because I can make those faster. So I get all the pie crust made. And for the ones that are a double crust, I'll make the bottom crust, and then I roll out the top crust and whatever decoration I put on it. And I stack them up, and I put them in the refrigerator. So then I can pull out a few at a time, and then I start in, and I'm very... Some say organized, some say nuts, but I have, okay, these bake at 350, these bake at 375, you know, whatever. And I can bake 8 small pies at a time.
So this one takes 2 eggs.
And it takes 2 days.
And you do them all in like a standard household oven?
Yeah, that's what everybody says. I'm like, well, I just have an oven. I don't know. It's a regular oven.
And it's going to take vanilla. And I make my own vanilla.
It smells fabulous.
It's really easy to do. You get the vanilla beans and vodka.
Oh.
That's what it is, yeah.
I have probably... I'm going to say maybe 50 or 60 different recipes, but not everybody. There are some that people really like, and there are some that I've got, like, one person likes this pie, mm-hmm. and somebody else wants only this pie.
Now, has this particular recipe developed over time, or?
It's my mother's recipe.
Oh, wonderful. Mm-hmm.
And she had made it for, forever. And, I just pretty much stick with what she had.
It's very fascinating to find out what you're working on and what your ties are to Muncie. And we're here specifically to say, Wewo, what are you working on?
What am I working on? Well, I'm always looking for new recipes.
Okay.
And I take suggestions from customers, from friends, and they say, have you ever made this? Well, why don't we try that? It's interesting. It really is to find like, oh, wow, that's really good. I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
I make pecan pies. So I saw a recipe that said caramel pecan, and I thought, well, that sounds good. We'll try that. So I did that. Then I saw another recipe that says chocolate pecan. I'm like, oh, yeah.
And I also pre-measure the pecans. It saves so much time if stuff's pre-measured.
And a friend of mine said, well, you make caramel and you make chocolate pecan. Why don't you make it turtle pecan and combine everything? So I did. I found a recipe. Well, first I just experimented. And then I found an actual recipe and tried several different versions and had my friends act as guinea pigs. And they go, that isn't it. No, not yet. And finally they said, that's it. So I now have a turtle pecan pie, and that's been the latest one that I've developed.
I love that story of the art of pie making, the looking for the right chemistry. And
that's exactly what it is. People don't understand that baking is chemistry. And I was a science major at Ball State, and one of my degrees is in science, and I taught science, one of my careers. And I was a home ec minor and a science major, and people would look at me like, are you crazy?
Did you always know that your two majors were going to lead?
Never.
Pie making?
Never.
No.
Never. Never.
Didn't cross your mind?
No. Never in a million years.
Now this one's going to be a chocolate pecan. So we'll add a bunch of chocolate to it.
And it's just chunks of chocolate.
Just chunks of chocolate, uh-huh. And this one, it's already overflowing.
Everything is carefully measured, but the chocolate is measured by love.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the best.
And then, put it in. Just a regular old oven.
Now, where is it that we could contact you to get a pie order and have a discussion about pies?
Well, I am on Facebook as The Pie Lady, and I get a lot of people that way, or I'm also on Facebook as Susan Danner. So either way, or people message me, they text me, whatever. They find a way.
Nice. thank you again so much for this and talking to us and spending a little time with us today.
I'm glad to. Thank you.
Well, that was delicious.
Indeed.
This is Pop of Culture on IPR. It's Pop of Culture. I'm Jen Blackmer.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey. Every week we ask an artist, what are you working on? That includes comedy writer James Brubeck. He sat down with our co-host, Kara Duquette.
We're here today with James Brubeck. He is a storyteller from Indiana. Whether it's writing, acting, or directing, or even being in the audience cheering, he's eager to be a part of storytelling. He has dreamed of making others laugh since he was 8 years old. Thank you for being here with us today, James.
Thank you for having me.
And, you know, we're going to ask our famous question, Weiwo, what are you working on?
Oh, man, what am I working on? A lot.
Do tell.
So there's the school projects, which are like, oh, production, you're writing for this production. Oh, you're helping with this documentary. Oh, you're doing your job as a GA and filming things that go on at the college. But in my personal life, I have been working on a production studio. When I first came to Ball State in my sophomore year, I had a professor ask me why I was here. And I looked him in the eyes and I said, I have stuff I want to make, and if no one else is going to do it, then I will. And the more I went through my schooling, the more I realized I didn't want to sacrifice my stories and the important messages that I could provide. And I realized that in order to get my stories out there in the way that I feel their integrity is there, I needed to make a company that could be the name that these stories stand under. So a production studio would be sort of the tools needed to make the stories. A producer is someone who hires the people, they fund the projects, they provide the equipment. They are the money pockets, if you will. They give you the money you need, except for I don't have money, so I've got to find a way to make money to produce these things. So I'm currently working on a sketch comedy show for that. I've always dreamed of doing something like that.
Excellent. So the work you're doing in school is feeding this sketch comedy project you're working on, would you say?
A little bit. It's keeping me working, because part of the problem with writing especially is like you hit a block where you're like, there's not much else I can do with this right now. And you either have to give in to quote-unquote defeat and work on something else, or you just sit and stew and get nowhere because you're sitting and stewing. And it's kind of helped me a lot with I'm still working on things. I'm working on things I'm proud of and getting experience and getting my name on things. And it's helped me to not only focus on one creative project.
Oh, I completely understand that. I don't look at leaving one project when you get stuck or blocked to another one as defeat. There's right. kind of a synergy sometimes, yeah. I think, when you're working on multiple things.
The only defeat that I feel about that sometimes is like when I'm on that roll on something and I'm like, I want to work on this. And I'm like, buddy, you're out of block. You just got to put it down for a second. And then I'm stubborn. And I'm like, no, I don't want to.
I want to figure it out now.
Yeah, I want the answer. Give it to me.
I get that. So who are some of your comedy mentors or people you find funny?
Oh, man.
I'm just curious.
I grew up watching SNL with my mom, and I think that's where it started. It was Kristen Wiig, Bill Hader seasons. Amy Poehler, of course, was there. And from there, I got into Smosh on YouTube. I was like 8 or 9 years old. And early YouTube sketch comedy was really pushed on there. It got a lot of views and it did really well. Smosh was a YouTube channel, is a YouTube channel, they're still going, of two guys who just made sketch comedy, and it was based around their friendship, and I saw them doing it. And that was kind of when I was like, oh my gosh, I can do this. My dream was being a YouTuber for a long time.
So where are you imagining that you will take your sketch comedy? How will that be put out to the public?
In the past, and I'm sure I'll continue to do it every now and again, I post on my own YouTube channel some sketch comedy, stuff I've made for classes, because of course when I'm doing class videos, I'm making little sketches. But I think it is kind of like the growing, the plant nursery, I guess, for my art, because a lot of my art starts there. And then sometimes I get one thing where I'm like, I can see this going further. Because doing sketch, like I did it for years as a kid and then I just stopped. And it was when I came back to school at Ball State that I started doing it again. And it's funny how that works, because then it started opening other doors of like, oh, wow, I have serious stories I want to write too. And I think that it is the door to open to the house of my work. I think comedy is who I am at my heart. Laughter is something very important to me. But I think to share heartfelt moments, I can't do it with people unless I can laugh with you.
Oh, I couldn't agree more with that. Because like even when you're thinking about exploring comedy, I mean, that can open to very serious topics.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. And even in the serious things I've been writing, I'm like, there's a little bit of comedy here. I got to work that out. And it was David Arquette, who I met in a class setting, where I was like, hey, I'm doing a piece about grief and like what it's like to lose your mother. And I realized like, is it okay to put something funny in there? He was like, absolutely. That's what makes it so relatable.
Yeah. You know, laughing instead of crying, or doing both, or, right, you know, nothing's like concretely just one emotion.
Oh,
right?
For sure. So I think some of the best cries I've had is when I start out just upset, and then like, I'll just go on this rant and be like, and I'm sad and I've had the worst day and now I'm just laying here crying. And then I start laughing because I'm like, what are you even crying about even more? You're laying in bed, you're crying. Yes. What else now? You've let it out.
Yeah. Where did this come from? Where's it going?
Right.
Now, is there anything else you'd like to talk to us about, you know, sketch comedy, your art, things you're working on?
I've been getting into stand-up.
Oh, wow. That's an interesting aspiration. I find that terrifying, the idea of stand-up.
I have done it once, and I plan to go out and do it again. I really just had to figure out, like, how do I write this now? Because this is a different genre of comedy. How do I write this? How do I want to present myself? And figuring out how to write that, and then figuring out a brand, because I talked to a teacher about it, and she was like, you have to figure out how to make yourself memorable. Like, what is your gimmick? What is your brand?
Well, is there any place that we can find you online and see some of your work?
Yes. I have an Instagram, james.brubeck, B-R-U-B-E-C-K. And then on there, all my fun little links are there. So my YouTube channel's there. And eventually when I do get the production company out, it will be promoed there, and all my fun little reels that I make in life.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. It was a delight talking to you today.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
It's time for the Arts Calendar. Are you ready,
Jen? Amazing, yes.
Are you looking to kick off the new year with new experiences?
It's my resolution.
Yes. Might we suggest a trip to a museum?
Always. Uh-huh. Here are a few exhibits to see before they close this month.
Yep. Crisis Canning at Minnetrista is on through January 26th. Featuring historic objects from Minnetrista's collection, this original exhibition will explore the history of canning during times of crisis. Visitors will learn more about the ancient and global art of food preservation and explore how wars, pandemics, and economic struggles have transformed canning from an ordinary mode of cooking into a form of emergency planning for Americans across the decades.
Also at Minnetrista and the Anderson Museum of Art, it's Open Space, Art About the Land, on display through January 5th. Since 2001, Open Space, Art About the Land has encouraged artists across the state to draw inspiration from the land that surrounds us. From painters to sculptors and beyond, the exhibition presents a diverse showcase of creative talent, celebrating the beauty achieved when nature inspires art.
Love that. And also, Jen, at the Anderson Museum, you can enjoy Hues of Happiness through January 5th.
The 126th Annual Exhibition of Indiana and Ohio Artists is on display through January 11th at the Richmond Museum of Art.
Awesome. At the Idle George Museum in Indianapolis, you can check out Alfred Jacob Miller, revisiting the rendezvous in Scotland and today through January 26th. Delve into the captivating world of artist Alfred Jacob Miller and explore the American West through his perspective. Best known for his vivid depictions of the legendary 1837 Rocky Mountain Rendezvous, Miller's paintings provide a fascinating glimpse into the historic event where fur traders, mountain men, and Native Americans converged in a spectacular display of culture and commerce.
At the Children's Museum of Indianapolis, you can see the global traveling exhibition, Mandela, the official exhibition. This immersive exhibit gives visitors the unique opportunity to learn more about the world's most iconic freedom fighter and Nobel Peace Prize laureate, Nelson Mandela. On display at the Children's Museum of Indianapolis through January 22nd.
Do you know of an exhibit we should see? Tell us at indianapublicradio.org/contact, then select Pop of Culture.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
And that's our show. This encore episode was produced by Luke Jones, the official exhibition, and was hosted by me, Michelle Kinsey.
And me, Jen Blackmer. Pop of Culture is a production of IPR on the campus of Ball State University.